This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of The New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
The field of Democrats running for president is, to say the least, hugely crowded. But Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, stands out for a few reasons. He's a Navy veteran, born and raised in the city he governs, so you could say he has real heartland credibility. He's also the first gay presidential candidate with a real shot at the nomination, and if elected, he'd be the youngest president by far. Buttigieg is a millennial who graduated high school in the year 2000. I spoke with him earlier this week. Mr. Mayor, I have to begin with a kind of good news, sort of bad news question. One day after Barack Obama met that one time with Donald Trump, I had an interview with the outgoing president in the Oval Office. It went for a couple of hours. The White House was like a funeral parlor. We talked a long time about the election just passed. And at one point I said, Mr. President, what do you have on the bench? What does the Democratic Party have on the bench? And he did a long kind of Obamian pause. And then he said, well, there's Kamala Harris in California. And I think he kind of made a routine mention of Tim Kaine. And then he said, and then there's that guy in South Bend, Indiana, the mayor. I think he was a Rhodes Scholar, he said. And then he couldn't quite place the name, or maybe he didn't dare try to pronounce it. What's been your relationship with Barack Obama?
I first spent a little time with him when he traveled to South Bend. He was on his way to Elkhart, and Elkhart County is, the RV capital of the country and something of a bellwether economically. And went through horrible circumstances in the Great Recession. And so he was coming toward the end of his presidency to take a bit of a victory lap and remind everybody how successful the auto rescue had been, because Elkhart was doing great by the end of his term. And they had arranged for me to spend some time with him in the vehicle as he went from South Bend Airport over to Elkhart, about a half hour that we got to chat. It's the only time in my life I've wished that commute would be longer instead of shorter. That was the first time, other than a handshake or a photo, that I'd really visited with him. But obviously admire him and have really admired a lot of the people he brought in to work with him.
How do you think his presidency fell short, if it did, and maybe led to a Trump presidency, if it did?
Well, I think his presidency was very constrained in a tactical sense. Of course, it was constrained by the partisan makeup of the Congress, and I would also argue by, in many cases, bad faith on the part of Senate and House Republicans, who it turned out were not very interested in compromise or in working together. But that also created some constraints that I would say mattered, not in the naive sense of them making the wrong call, but just literally how far you could go. I mean, for example, if you want to if you wish, as I do, that there had been at least a public option as part of the ACA, you got to remember that it was only for a matter of, I think, months that he even had 60 votes in the Senate to work with. So, you know, I think they went as far as they could in the direction of progress, given a lot of institutional constraints. But I think there was an even bigger kind of global constraint that affected that presidency, which was that it was still part of a 40-some year era that you might call a Reagan consensus, when a conservative or neoliberal economic worldview really dictated how both Republicans and Democrats were supposed to behave. So, you know, for some of the same reasons that a Republican president like Nixon was doing a lot of pretty progressive things on domestic policy that would have still placed him a little bit on the right side of the spectrum as it was in America at the time in the 70s. Democratic presidents in my lifetime, Clinton and Obama both, I think, have been operating in a fundamentally conservative framework. And it's something we should remember when we think about the shortcomings or the things that didn't happen that we wish would.
Well, you said this very recently to the Washington Post, I believe it was. Donald Trump got elected because in his twisted way, he pointed out the huge troubles in our economy and in our democracy. At least he didn't go around saying that America was already great like Hillary did. Now, I know you've backtracked a little bit about that latter bit, but you're saying something pretty large there. What is it?
Yeah, so I know that quotation got circulated a lot. That was something I said last year, and I think appeared in a profile in January, and it got circulated, unfortunately, a little bit without context. But the point I'm making here is that a presidency like this doesn't just happen. A figure like Donald Trump doesn't just become possible unless there's a real sense of brokenness in our political and economic system that makes it possible not only for racist and xenophobic appeals to get more traction, but also for a lot of people who have been historically Democratic to vote a different way, almost as a vote to burn the house down. And you saw a lot of people, people aligned with labor, people who had been in the habit of voting Democratic, who were really angry at the system or what they perceived the system to be, both economically and politically. And so even though pretty much everything the president said wasn't true when he said, for example, that elections were rigged in the sense of, busloads of immigrants coming to vote. Obviously, that was false. But it's not false that elections are rigged in the sense that districts are drawn to where most of their outcomes are decided in advance, and politicians choose their voters rather than the other way around. When he said the economy was rigged, obviously, I think it's clear to many of us that he's among the class of people that helped to rig it. But there was also some truth to that. And so to the extent that we, the Democratic Party, in 2016, were perceived as saying that the system was fine. So he was saying, I'm going to blow up the system. And we were saying, trust the system. A lot of people, especially people in industrial Midwestern communities like mine, didn't find our message to be convincing because the system really had let them down in the sense that, the rising tide rose just as we were promised it would, but most of our boats didn't budge.
As a senior in high school, you wrote an admiring and an award-winning essay on Bernie Sanders. And I wonder if in the campaign last time around, you were hoping that Bernie Sanders would edge out Hillary Clinton.
I supported her at the end of the day in that process. I do think that a lot of the traction that he got was part of that same instinct, which was operative among us Democrats, as it was in the nation at large, that there was something really wrong and really ripe for change in the system. So in the end, I believe that she was the best prepared to be president. But I do think that message got traction for some good reasons.
Do you think he would have won? Do you think he would have beaten Trump?
I don't know. I'm certainly struck by the number of people who seem to think that those were the only two people they would have voted for. I mean, it kind of shows you how kind of a simple 90s account of how ideology works doesn't really explain what was going on in the 2016 election.
Now, I've got to ask you, you're 2 years older than the minimum to run for president. In the presidential race, there are at least three leading candidates who are over 70 or close to it: Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders. Are they too old to be president?
It's not my place to say why or whether anybody else should run or not. I do think that there's a lot of energy and interest in a new generation putting forward leaders. The consequences for my generation of the decisions being made right now are enormous. I mean, almost by definition, the longer you're planning to be here, the more you have at stake. And when you add to that some of these questions that I think are questions of intergenerational justice, like how can you pass a completely unaffordable trillion-dollar tax cut for the wealthiest, or you know, how can you go any longer without doing anything meaningful about climate change? I think those have a strong generational angle. And I think, you know, we've been a party that generally has an appetite for new leadership and new faces. One interesting thing that it's not intuitive because they entered our consciousness at different ages, but it's true if you go look it up, is that three of our last four presidents, Clinton, Bush, and Trump, are all almost precisely the same age. They were all born in the same summer of, I believe, 46. And so it does feel like maybe we're ripe for a watershed moment. But at the end of the day, any candidate needs to be able to explain why they should be supported, not just on the basis of their profile, but on the basis of their message.
No, I don't mean to be a wise guy by saying this, but that sounds like a polite version of a yes to my question, that they are too old in a sense, in a substantive way.
You know, I don't know that I can embrace that. Look, one very interesting thing, for example, that you saw with the Sanders phenomenon is that a lot of younger voters were gravitating toward an older candidate. By the way, conversely, one thing I've learned in my career from beginning when I ran for mayor is that a lot of older voters are among the most excited about a younger candidate. So, you know, I think somebody of any age can deliver a compelling message. I do think we're in a generational moment that makes it perhaps more appealing or more meaningful than usual to have somebody stepping forward from a generation that's not been represented at the highest levels just yet in America, but is demonstrating leadership across the world. I mean, most recently, you saw the Prime Minister of New Zealand, who I believe she is younger than I would be when I would take office, who's one of a number of leaders. Macron's another example in France, who is exactly the age or took office at exactly the age that I would. The world, and some of these leaders may be better than others, but the world is beginning to put forward leaders from this new generation, and it's almost uncharacteristic that America has been slow to do the same.
The question you're going to get at every campaign stop and at every pain in the neck interviewer like me is your experience so far in political terms has been to be the mayor of a modest sized city, South Bend, Indiana, which is just over 100,000 people. Is that adequate experience to be commander in chief and president of the United States?
So I get the audacity of somebody in my position talking about the highest office in the land, although I think it is no less audacious and a little bit obscene for any mortal to look at that office and think that they belong there, that they could just walk in.
Obama used to say you have to be a little bit crazy to think that you can run for that office.
Of course, or to think that you could do it. And yet every one of the 45 people we've put in there has been a human being with a certain set of experiences. I would argue that the set of experiences I have is about as relevant as it can get without having already been president. You know, to have the experience of managing everything from infrastructure to economic development, to know in a very literal sense what it is to get a 3 a.m. phone call and have to make decisions, to be managing everything from a parks and recreation puzzle to the urgent question of how to hold a community together when there's a racially sensitive officer involved shooting. I mean, from hour to hour and sometimes minute to minute, you experience the full range of what's expected and required in government leadership. Not to mention the fact that I have more military experience than I think anybody to go into that office since George H.W. Bush. You know, it's a non-traditional model. I get that for a mayor to go in this direction. We're roughly the 300th city in rankings by size. But I think if I were the 300th most senior member of Congress, I'm not sure I'd be getting the same question, which is odd because you could be a very senior member of Congress and have never in your life managed more than 100 people.
And in fairness, Barack Obama was a U.S. senator for about 10 minutes before he got the question, are you going to run for president of the United States? You referred to a 3 a.m. phone call. What was that?
Well, sometimes it can be about a violent incident or a SWAT team call out. We've also had natural disasters. I've had to activate the Emergency Operations Center of the city twice over the course of 2 years for historic flooding, which, by the way, is one reason why I view climate change as an issue that's happening not only in the Arctic, but in the Midwest. And that's why I view it as a security issue. I mean, to have had a 500-year flood and a 1,000-year flood take place within 18 months of each other on my watch, it brings home to me just how pressing an issue like that is. But it also teaches you about everything from incident command to big picture policy.
Now, you talk a lot about the concept of intergenerational justice. What exactly does that mean in practice and on a policy level?
Well, again, climate is a very pressing example of this. I mean, there will be a reckoning for the costs that have been run up by essentially discounting the future to the point where you just view it as somebody else's problem. And unfortunately, the somebody else is us. The somebody else is a generation that's alive today and will be paying the price. So if we were properly accounting for the consequences for my generation and those coming next when it comes to climate, we wouldn't be having a debate over whether we could afford to do a carbon tax. We'd be having a debate over how we could possibly afford to do anything but a major mobilization around this issue. I also think it's a lens that maybe could help us navigate the challenging questions around reparations, which are very much a question, I think, of what one generation owes to another and how injustices or choices or inequities made in one moment in time can be visited upon the heads not just of others living in that time, but of others not yet born.
Well, what would be your specific policy suggestion on reparations, an idea that was popularized by Ta-Nehisi Coates not long ago, but we're hearing this as a campaign discussion quite a lot, maybe to the surprise of many people, but not a lot of specifics about it. Same with the Green New Deal. There are principles being and energy being thrust into the debate, which is fantastic, but a lot of specifics seem to be missing. So start with reparations.
Well, I think that's partly because nobody has it fully figured out, but we do, I think, increasingly have a consensus that it deserves to be looked at and taken seriously. It's one of the reasons why there's a lot of traction for a proposal to set up a commission that would try to have a mature conversation about what this means. One way to look at it, and this is a framework, not a fully articulated plan, but what I would want to do would be to look at every inequity in our society that we know is at least partly the result of intentional, harmful, race-based policy. You don't have to look that far. For example, there's a really important book that came out, I think, last year called The Color of Law. It explains how a lot of the racial segregation taking place in our neighborhoods that we maybe treat today as de facto actually happened as the result of very specific and very racist policy choices going back at least to the FDR administration. You would think it would make sense if resources went into creating that racial inequity, that resources would go into reversing it, perhaps targeting housing aid in certain ways by neighborhood, perhaps making sure that grant funding available to schools is allocated in a way that takes into account which school districts are in areas that were deliberately harmed by intentional race-based racist policy, or maybe other dimensions that haven't really been fully analyzed or mapped out. But the point is, we need to begin to build the capacity to do this. And when we do it right, we can also get out of the current framework that the issue is being talked about. The very reason why the right, I think, in a cynical way, is kind of salivating for this to be more of a campaign issue, which is everybody thinking of it as a check in the mail, which makes it very hard to come up with a fair explanation for who's supposed to get the check and who it's supposed to come out of.
Yeah, and what about the Green New Deal? Where are you on that?
So here are the things I think the Green New Deal gets right. First of all, it correctly positions climate as a major challenge, a national security challenge whose destructive power is on par with that of a depression or a war. And therefore, it follows that we need to have a national level of mobilization to do something about it. The second thing that it gets right is, in the same way that the World War II was part of what ended the Great Depression, we can create economic opportunity through that mobilization. Now, I don't know that all of the sort of kitchen sink qualities of the way it's sometimes talked about makes sense. I'm not sure this is the place to house some of the policy things I'd like to see us do around healthcare or some of the ideas around a jobs guarantee, for example. But it is the case, and I think the Green New Deal is correct in this regard, that we need to act incredibly quickly at a scale that we've not seen in the country other than other major mobilizations to put somebody on the moon or beat the Nazis, for example. And that if we do it right, there's a lot of opportunity in having that national project. Yes, it's more a set of goals than it is a fully laid out plan. But, you know, the rocket trajectories had not been calculated when President Kennedy said we needed to go to the moon. He rallied the country around a goal.
Mr. Mayor, the right has very successfully painted the Democratic Party as the party of the coastal elites. Now, you are mayor of a Midwestern city, so you would certainly escape that. And you've served in the military, which distinguishes you from just about everybody in the race. But at the same time, you have Harvard University, Oxford University, and an area where you'll probably get hit from the left, you worked at McKinsey for a few years. Why did you work at McKinsey? And what do you make of the reporting on McKinsey's work advising Purdue Pharma on how to turbocharge, their word, OxyContin sales, and how they counsel dictators worldwide on how to build more efficient autocracies? Is your work for McKinsey something that you're proud of in the rearview mirror?
I'm proud of the work that I did for our clients. I worked on everything from grocery pricing to renewable energy. And I would not have worked on a client engagement that I didn't believe was ethical as well as helpful or at least not problematic in that way. I went to work at McKinsey because I wanted to understand how the world worked, how people, goods, and money move around the world. And I wanted that kind of private sector experience, and they were willing to take a chance on me even though I didn't have an MBA. And teach me what I needed to know about business. It was a phenomenal learning opportunity.
But are you angry? You know, are you angry at McKinsey for their work on Purdue Pharma and various dictators around the world?
Of course. I mean, my community has been harmed by irresponsible behavior of corporations in the opioid industry, and I think it shocks the conscience any time that a murderous dictator can rely on the legitimacy of a Western consulting company, especially the most prestigious company out there, in order to further their goals. And I think that, you know, this firm needs to be a lot more selective and a lot more thoughtful in the work that it does. I mean, client service firms always have a bit of a tradition of being amoral, and I think that flows from the legal industry, where you don't as often, I think, hold it against a firm if, for example, a criminal defense attorney at that firm represents a nefarious criminal. But it is a little different and should be when it comes to consulting. There should be a higher standard because while everybody recognizes there is a right to legal counsel, I'm not convinced that there is any kind of right to management consulting services.
When you look at Amazon, Facebook, and Google, do you see them as monopolies? And if so, should they be broken up?
In some respects, they behave monopolistically, and whenever they're using dominance of one market to try to get dominance in another, then I think that means they might need to be broken up, or there might need to be a prevention of a further deal or acquisition. I think the FTC should be empowered to do that. I also think, though, that we're having a conflated conversation that should probably be two different conversations. One is about how big these companies have become and some of the harm that comes from that. And, you know, it's particularly true when you see some of the problems that come with just the emptying out of small communities that can't deal with big retailers. And that was just, you know, it's something we learned to talk about when we were dealing with Walmart that was still brick and mortar, becoming even more of a challenge when you have someone like Amazon kind of gobbling up the market share. That's only half of the reason I think we're concerned about tech. The other half has to do with data security and data privacy. And dealing with the monopoly problem is neither necessary nor sufficient to deal with their conduct when it comes to data. It's why we need a national framework for data law that establishes the rights we have over the data we create and the responsibilities that that go along with collecting that data. Europe has a robust, if imperfect, regulatory setup. We have basically 50 regulatory schemes for 50 states, and we need a national policy on this because over time, data will continue to become one of the most valuable things any one of us generates. And yet right now, we have very few rights over it.
Now, you're part of the generation for whom the internet is absolutely intrinsic. You're born into it. How has the web changed our culture for the good and how for the ill? How can it be made less toxic?
Well, I think, you know, it's changed our relationship to knowledge. The fact that increasingly knowledge is simply at our fingertips is unbelievably important and empowering. It's also brought us together in many ways and created different ways for us to engage. I met my husband through an app that talks to social networking sites, and that's how we were sort of suggested to each other, and it turned out to be a great match. There's a lot of tremendous good that can come, obviously, from the way our relationship to information in my lifetime has been transformed. And, of course, a lot of harm. I remember when Mark Zuckerberg visited South Bend, one of the things I wanted—
A friend of yours from college, right?
I hadn't known him in college, but I met him after that, and he wanted to go to every state in the country, and so I made sure that I encouraged him to visit South Bend, hoping he would take a look at our tech sector, but he was interested in criminal justice reform, and so I took him to the juvenile justice facility here. More than one of the kids, inmates that we met there, told him that they wished that social media didn't exist because it was through a fight or something that started on social media that their lives had taken a bad turn.
Do you agree? Do you wish that social media didn't exist?
I can't wish that because I wouldn't be married to my husband if it didn't exist. Look, again, it's like saying is text a good or a bad idea? Should we or should we not have images? This is a thing that is so suffused in everything that we do that, of course, it can do good and bad. The question is, what are we going to do about it? And these solutions can't come from the tech companies themselves. I mean, right now we're in a world where anytime a large company, a Facebook or a Google, makes a corporate policy decision, they're actually making a public policy decision because of the power they have and the influence they have. But more than anything, because the policy world has failed to create the left and right boundaries they're supposed to work in. And I'm not sure they want to be dealing with these things either. So this is something that needs to be set by democratic means, not by corporate means. And, you know, the spectacle of tech executives being quizzed by legislators who make it abundantly clear they don't even understand the thing they're supposed to be regulating, basically sets us up for failure in terms of how this is supposed to work in our society.
You mentioned your husband. There was recently an article in Slate that I found actually quite confounding, but let me quote it for you. It says, Buttigieg, for instance, would register on only the most finely tuned gaydar. That doesn't mean he's not gay enough. There's really no such measure. It just means that he might not be up against quite the same hurdles that a gay candidate without such sturdy ties to straight culture would be. Now, you're going to get written about every which way till Sunday in all different directions. And when you read something like that, what do you make of it?
Well, I don't love it. It's I get it. I remember, some of the same kind of strange conversations happening around the historic quality of President Obama's candidacy and presidency.
Meaning the critique that he wasn't really black, that kind of thing.
All that kind of stuff about, whether his black experience counted the same as other people's black experience. I can only speak to my own experience and ours, and I'm not interested in getting into a kind of oppression Olympics over, who has suffered in which ways for being gay or any other kind of minority. I am interested in tapping into the experience that Chasten and I have had as a happy married couple, but also as people who know what it's like to be othered, and to hopefully use that as some basis for solidarity, not only with other members of the LGBTQ community, but anybody who, for whatever reason, has experienced exclusion or wondered whether they belong. And I think there's a lot of potential for our experience to help. I know there is because I talk to people who have been impacted in some way just by the fact of me getting into the field. And, you know, people are going to write what they're going to write. And you know, you can't get too absorbed in it or else you'd lose your mind.
Now, you were not out, at least publicly, until a very few years ago. As an ambitious person in public service, how did that decision work? Why the reluctance, if that's what it was?
Well, I first had to overcome a lot of personal reluctance to just admitting this simple fact of myself about myself, although I got over that somewhere in my 20s. Then once I did, as a friend pointed out the first time I came out to anyone, he reminded me that I hadn't really made it easy on myself professionally because there were two parts to my career then. One of them was public service in Indiana. And the other one was military service as an officer in the Navy Reserve. And so both of those were, one of them by law, one of them just de facto, both of those were professional choices that were strictly incompatible with being an out gay person. It was a matter of law that I could not serve in the military and be out. And it was at least a conventional wisdom that I could either be an elected official in Indiana or I could be out, but I could not be both. And so, needless to say, that helped motivate me to drag my feet on coming out. What changed all that? Well, two things. One, as I grew older, I realized that I couldn't go on like that forever. But then the thing that really put me over the top was the military deployment, where I took a leave from serving as mayor to go serve overseas. And it just, something about that really clarified my awareness of the extent to which you only get to live one life and be one person.
Well, tell me about that deployment. What happened?
Well, part of it was just the exposure to danger. Even the fact of writing the letter that I wrote to my family before I left, just in case. And
what did the letter say?
Well, a lot of it was about why I felt that my life, how I felt my life fit together, and why I didn't want them to think that I'd been cheated if I didn't come back, because I had such a full life up till then. I was 32, 33. But at the same time, I realized that there was something really important that was missing. And I began to feel a little bit humiliated about the idea that I could, my life could come to an end and I could be a visible public official and a grown man and a homeowner and have no idea what it was like to be in love.
And did you come out to your parents in that letter, to your family?
No, I did that after I came back, pretty soon after I came back, though.
So you were deployed to Afghanistan, which is the longest war in American history. How does that conflict finally end? How should it end? And how will you assess it?
Well, I think it's ending. I mean, this is maybe where the debate needs to go is not whether it should end, but will it end well or badly? And what does that, you know, what does that actually mean? Because one thing that the American left, it seems now the American right, the Afghan government, and the Taliban all seem to want is for us to leave. To me, what success looks like is not to believe that Afghanistan can become a unified Western-style democracy with a developed country economy just yet. I think success in the American interest is some level of assurance that it's not going to be a place that again leads to an attack on the American homeland. I think the international community has an interest also in human rights in Afghanistan, and especially the rights of women, and we should participate in support for that. But in terms of what would motivate U.S. military, continued U.S. military involvement, we've got to be more careful and more serious about the thresholds for us to commit troops abroad. And, you know, this is a conflict that you could be old enough to enlist now and have not even been alive on 9/11. When I was leaving in 2014, I thought I was one of the last troops there. I was helping to shut down the unit that I had been part of, or at least its presence in my part of the country. And so, you know, to have believed I was part of the tail end of it 5 years ago and it's still going on tells us that we have not succeeded in figuring out how to get out. And the time has come more than once.
Mr. Mayor, President Trump has consistently labeled China as our biggest geopolitical foe, particularly on trade. And you represent a town, South Bend, Indiana, which has suffered major deindustrialization. That was probably your chief mission, to figure out what to do about that. How do you feel about the president's use of tariffs? Surely that's hit South Bend.
It has, and it's not been terribly helpful because we have in the South Bend metro area more companies that use and purchase steel than we have companies that make it. And various businesses were anxiously watching the rules come out to figure out whether their particular product did or didn't qualify for the different tariffs that are being created. Even our conservative and normally Trump-aligned member of Congress for this district broke with the president on the subject of tariffs because it was not good for our economy. It also speaks, though, to the broader issue, which is that most of what accounts for the changes that have happened to our part of the industrial Midwest is technological. Some of it has to do with trade. But it's just easier to blame another country or to blame immigrants than it is to confront some of the faceless but profound changes that have come our way to do with, for example, technology and automation. But that's simply smoke and mirrors compared to if it becomes an excuse to not face the deeper and tougher issue. And I'll tell you something else about China. You know, I do believe that China's emerging as a competitor, not just a competitor, but in many ways an adversary. And the Chinese model is also being held up globally as an alternative to our model, and I very much believe in our model versus theirs. But I will say this, there's an assembly line that was part of AM General, which makes Hummers, where they got a contract deal for 3 years on what used to be an old commercial line, to manufacture Mercedes R-Class vehicles. Now, this is an SUV that is only sold in Asian markets. And so what you had was American auto workers, union auto workers, by the way, making German cars going to Chinese customers. And when that contract ran its course, the line was sold to another company, which is Chinese owned. It's a startup based in Silicon Valley, and they make electric vehicles. Again, employing by the hundreds American union auto workers.
Now, you can't do everything first as a president. What would be your signature first priority policy as the holder of that office? What would you really look at to spend your political capital on right away?
Democratic reform. The condition of our democracy is diminished, and the worse it gets, the harder it will become for us to fix anything else, any of the top issues we care about, of which I think climate is the most pressing. For the rest of my life, our system of government will be probably inadequate to the moments we face unless we fix it.
So we're talking voter suppression, redistricting, finance?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the contents of HR1 would be a good place to start. We also need to be, I think, considering structural reform. So in addition to redistricting and money in politics and voter suppression, I think we need to look at the whether we're going to continue to allow D.C. not to be a state. We should look at whether the Supreme Court can be reformed so that it is less political. The Senate's going to have to figure out whether the filibuster is appropriate to the modern environment. I suspect it is not. We really need to look at the big questions, and it is entirely possible that the House of Representatives has the wrong number of representatives, that the U.S. Supreme Court has the wrong number of justices, and that the United States has the wrong number of states.
I think you're looking at a constitutional convention, aren't you?
Maybe a convention, maybe a series of amendments like we had in the late 1970s, many of them spearheaded by Indiana Senator Birch Bayh. I mean, this stuff is not crazy out of left field. This is something that the United States has routinely done in every era except the one that I'm living in.
But the memories of the court packing debacle under Franklin Roosevelt are, at least for historians, pretty fresh. How do you propose rationalizing increasing the size of the Supreme Court?
Well, it's not simply about adding to it in order to take it toward the left because it's too conservative, even though I do think it is too conservative. It's about a structural reform that will make that body less political. We can't go on like this where every vacancy turns into an apocalyptic ideological battle. So there are many options for reform. I'm not wedded to one of them, although the one I think is the most attractive, which I think will be discussed in a forthcoming Yale Law Journal article, would be to have 15 members, but only 10 of them selected by the traditional political process, and the other 5 selected in a process which requires the other 10 to agree unanimously. There are other, perhaps less structurally complex ideas, like having it become a rotation off the appellate bench. But my point is, whatever mechanism we choose, we need to make sure that this body, which, by the way, I think has been restructured something like 6 times, or at least had its size changed 6 times in U.S. history, we need to make sure that we have a structure that stops this trajectory toward coming to be viewed as a nakedly political institution, which is bad for the court and bad for the country.
So this collection of reforms and changes is what you would put your political capital on far before, say, a green initiative, an environmental initiative?
The way I would put it is you need to set these democratic reforms into motion right away. And then I think the top individual policy issue to take up is climate. But we can't I think we've for a long time known that some of these structural problems, the Electoral College is another one, have diminished our democracy. But we've tolerated it because it always felt like something else was more urgent. What we're realizing is we are totally sclerotic in our ability to manage even the most urgent issues. When you have 80 or 90% of Americans believing that we should at least do universal background checks, but Congress can't make it happen, when immigration reform, the most divisive issue of our moment, is actually the subject of an American consensus, if you look at the popularity of a comprehensive immigration reform along the lines of what once passed in the Senate but couldn't get through the House, when you think of our total inability to have a debate over who's got the best plan for climate change because folks in Washington are still arguing over whether there even ought to be a plan, what you see is that the center of gravity of the American political system is no longer within shooting distance of the center of gravity of the American people. The longer that goes, the more twisted and dangerous outcomes you get. I'm worried that this could eventually lead to the instability that could even cause political violence, and I believe it's absolutely helped lead to the presidency we're living with now.
Now, it's extremely early in the race, but you've got a lot of energy on your side, even though it's a very crowded field. Mm-hmm. Let's think ahead to post-nomination. Let's say you get the nomination, and you are pitted against one of the most unpredictable minds, let's put it this way, and debaters in the history of American politics. How do you propose to defeat Donald Trump on a debate stage and in general? What's the wrong way to go about it, and what's the right way to go about it?
Well, the wrong way to go about it is to be focused on him and how to defeat him, to concoct in your mind the masterful zinger that is going to lay him flat on the debate stage, because it just doesn't work that way. It doesn't matter in some regards what you say. Any energy or attention, including critical energy or attention that comes his way, is something that he absorbs and feeds off of and becomes bigger from. So if you really want to defeat him, you have to create an environment where it's not all about him. If you're just thinking up the great line to get him at the debate, you're setting up a framework where it's almost as though he's the one you're trying to impress. What we need to do is quickly, effectively, and flatly correct any lies that he tells and confront any bad policies he puts forward, and then move on
to what the world ought to look like. The press has been correcting these lies at a rate of thousands every few months to very little effect, it would seem, sometimes.
Exactly, because that's just table stakes. That doesn't get the job done. You have to do it because you can't fail to do it. But that's not how you're going to win. How you're going to win is to put forward something better and to remind people that this presidency is going to come and go, that it's not all about him. It's one of the reasons I talk a lot about my concern for what the world will look like in 2054 when I come to be the age he is now. We need to treat this presidency as a symptom, not a cause. Even though it can be mesmerizing, as many grotesque things are, at the end of the day, pointing out all the ways in which he's terrible does not amount to a message. A message is something that would make as much sense 10 years from now or in 2054 as it does today, which means it can't revolve around the personality or the deficiencies of the president.
In that context, and not in the spirit of insult, but in the context of learning something, what was the biggest mistake that Hillary Clinton made in her campaign, or the top three anyway?
Well, again, I think the biggest problem that we had, and this wasn't just tactics on the part of the campaign, this is also partly a consequence of the media environment. But the biggest problem was the extent to which we were regarded as defenders of the system. And so even though we had better policies, our policies were perceived as sort of a what might be called a framework reproducing activity that was going to roughly keep things the same, and people were so disgusted with the way things had worked out for them that they wanted to burn the house down. I mean, one way to think about it is, how do you get a so-called economic anxiety election when you're under conditions of statistical full employment? And why do those appeals, naked appeals sometimes to xenophobia and racism, work on the very same voters who made the difference for Barack Obama? And all of this adds up to an environment where anything that looked insider, anything that looked, frankly, overly familiar, and certainly anything that looked committed to the way things currently work in our democracy or our economy, was not going to be convincing. And look, it's easy with the benefit of hindsight to point to these problems. I don't pretend to have been sitting there at the time waving my arms saying that we needed to do all these things differently. But the whole point of hindsight, now that we have it, is that we recognize that we can do some things differently in 2020. And while there are a number of reasons, many of them nefarious, why this president won, we also absolutely must recognize that our strategy in 2016 was not flawless. And more than that, that it should never have been close. That, a president like this should never have come within cheating distance of winning. And yet here we are.
How do you appeal to those millions of voters who voted for Barack Obama and then voted for Donald Trump? Why did they do that, and how do you appeal to them?
Around here, some of those same people also voted for Mike Pence and voted for me. I think it is about making sure that it is not about him or about us, but rather about them. In other words, if your message is all about candidates, whether it's the candidate you're for or the candidate you're opposing, a lot of voters will say, nobody's talking to me. And we need to make sure that everything we care about is expressed not only in terms of our highest values, but also in terms of everyday outcomes. This is why, in my opinion, the Affordable Care Act, for example, went from being a toxic issue for Democrats in 2010 to being the winning issue for Democrats in 2018. What changed? Well, it actually happened, and people could see how it worked for them. And you saw ordinary Americans at town halls getting in the faces of members of Congress, describing their own lives and the impact that this policy had had on them, because it turns out it's just a lot harder to lie to somebody about their own life than it is to lie about some mysterious group or theoretical future. So we need to be more grounded. We need to keep it closer to the everyday impact, which, by the way, also philosophically ought to be the way we can justify everything we do. Otherwise, we shouldn't be doing it.
Mr. Mayor, you had a political decision to make, and it was a complicated one, whether to run for president, whether to run for governor in the same year, 2020, or maybe Senate down the line in 2022. Why did you decide to go for the whole ball of wax?
Well, I'm as surprised as anybody, especially if you were to ask me 2 or 3 years ago, to find myself in this situation now. I never believed in running for an office so that you can run for some other office. I think the discernment process of running for office has to do with mapping out two things. One, what the office calls for, and two, what you bring to the table. So I ran for mayor, for example, at a time when there was a crisis of confidence in the city. It seemed to be bleeding its youth, and there was a lot of controversy over whether the city was even open for business. And I thought, I'm a young person who believes in the city with a business background. I could do some good here. The process, I think, by the way, has also led me to not run for office more than once, including some opportunities to run for Congress. I think the process ultimately is about figuring out what's needed. And I think what's needed right now is something completely different, but still also having some regard for experience in government, but recognizing that maybe today experience in Washington is not the best or only proxy for meaningful experience in government. Coming from a region that my party seemed to have lost touch with a little bit, representing a generation whose time has come, and offering a message that I think is a little more willing to consider the structural and profound questions at stake in the tectonic shifts at our country. We're not just facing another election. we're facing a period between two eras in American politics. What I was describing earlier is a sort of Reagan consensus that explained the behavior of presidents of both parties for the last 40 years, and whatever's next. And whatever's next could be really enlightened, and it could be really ugly. But that's going to be decided in these years and these decisions. And I find, as much as I admire so many of the others, I find that I am not like the others. And one of the things that's different about my approach is a willingness to consider these bigger structural questions, even at risk of sounding a little too bold to be part of a tradition-laden discussion like that about the American presidency. So I didn't see an opportunity to make the same kind of profound difference running for governor or running for Senate. And so instead I will either continue down the path to the presidency or find some other way to make myself useful if voters have a different idea for me.
Mr. Mayor, thank you so much.
Same here. Good to be with you.
That was Pete Buttigieg, mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and one of more than a dozen Democrats running for president in 2020. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.